I'd like to welcome everyone here tonight for this evening with Ward Churchill. Just to let you know how this evening is structured, we have two brief speakers before Professor Churchill who are representing the two groups who are receiving the proceeds from tonight's event, and that will be the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty and the Third Encounter for Humanity and Against Neoliberalism. And from that group, the Third Encounter, right now we're going to hear from Rebecca de Bondendung, who's a member of the Wasasking First Nation and who works with the Third Encounter. Rebecca?
Ani Bojo, good evening, everybody. It's so great to see so many people here tonight. And to welcome Ward Churchill here to Mississauga First Nation and Toronto. Tonight, I originally wasn't slotted in to speak. A good friend of mine was, and for many people in this room, he was probably a good friend to all as well, or at least had come to your lives in one way or another. That's Rodney Bobbywash I'm speaking about, and most people here probably know that he passed away on Sunday, which is a tremendous loss to all of us as people who are committed to social justice on all many different levels, and people who are just community members in this community. So I'd like to honor Rodney and just share a few words about him. Rodney was a man whose ability to see the beauty of his people, humanity, and the universe created a passion so large that he dedicated his life to fighting to maintain its integrity. Rodney fought with conviction because he knew right from wrong, humane from inhumane, justice from injustice, and in knowing the differences between them, he also knew that there was no room for compromise. How does one compromise the justice of a people? Rodney shared himself with his people and anyone who wanted to listen. I remember going to his office at the Center for World Indigenous Studies with a list of questions, and he'd move away a pile of papers from his desk, make himself comfortable, and share the knowledge he'd gained from his many travels, years of study, and his heart. Rodney always had a way of putting things, whether he was telling you how horrible the book you were reading was, or how his friend Kimi Pernia Domingo had been kidnapped and killed by paramilitaries in Colombia, and he was still on a hunger strike. Rodney never hid the truth from anybody. Rodney called Bloor and Spadina home, he called Toronto home, and he saw the power beneath the heavy pavement of the streets and sidewalks and knew whom it belongs to. Turtle Island was Rodney's home. For Rodney, the world was a vat of knowledge waiting to be drunk. He told me his next project was to visit every country in the Americas. You know, Rodney really didn't fight for anybody. He fought for himself and his right to be Anishinaabe. It was in him being Anishinaabe and all the responsibilities and obligations that come with it that he saw no other choice. That fight included his Indigenous brothers and sisters from all over the world, the poor and those traumatized by conflict, fighting against racism, fighting for the acceptance of Indigenous knowledge in Western institutions, fighting to maintain our traditional ways. Rodney believed you could only fight on behalf of yourself. And Rodney's fight affected everyone who was lucky enough to have spent time with him. Because if you did, not only did you learn an immense amount of meaningful knowledge, but he was also always intent on making you laugh. Sometimes he would resort to throwing finger foods like cherry tomatoes and broccoli at total strangers, then point towards you. I've spent the past couple of years following Rodney around. I've even followed him around with a camera for a few months making a video documentary. Rodney introduced me to the encounter and all the possibilities within it. What appears idealist and altruistic and a lost cause to most was totally logical to Rodney. There is either justice or there isn't. We fight for our survival or we do not survive. Rodney believed that Indigenous people are like the canary in the mine. Once we are gone, the planet is gone. Rodney was a mentor, a teacher, a leader, a scholar, a visionary, a poet, an inspiration, and a friend. He was the backbone of the encounter and a leader to so many groups he was involved with. And at this point, I feel lost without him. On behalf of the encounter, I would like to express my deepest sadness for his passing. For the encounter, it is a tremendous loss. Rodney touched the lives of not only Indigenous people on Turtle Island, but of Indigenous people and non-Aboriginal people from around the world. Sorry.
Okay, hold on. Take a breather. Okay. Just take a breather for a second. I guess we're going to leave that right there with the message you gave. And at this time, I'll call up the people from OCAP.
Well, it's really great to see so many here tonight. Thank you for coming. Thank you for your support of OCAP and of the other organizations that are going to benefit from this tonight. My name is James Porter, and like the sister before me, I was sort of put into this position right at the last minute because Sue Collis and Sean Brandt, who were going to come and talk, are a bit indisposed, and some of you may know that that Sue's about ready to deliver a wonderful new addition to our human community. Some of you may have heard about OCAP, Ontario Coalition Against Poverty. Some of you may not. I won't try to say everything that could be said, but just a couple of things. OCAP has a kind of motto that we operate on the streets and we operate in the courts, and it's called fight to win. Fight to win, whatever it takes. And that's what OCAP tries to do. Sometimes people in the press and people in the mayor's office, people in the police department don't take too kindly to OCAP. Sometimes they say they're a little bit nervous when OCAP shows up. Why would that be? OCAP has a kind of memory. OCAP remembers what this government has done. OCAP remembers this government as a homicidal criminal organization. OCAP remembers Dudley George. OCAP remembers Kimberly Rogers. OCAP remembers the people from Walkerton. OCAP remembers the scores and scores and scores of men and women that have died on the streets of this city because they had no place to shelter themselves from the cold. And not just this city, but cities all across this province. And OCAP fights that, and OCAP welcomes your support in that fight, because we believe that's all of our fight. None of us are going to have dignity, none of us are going to have respect, unless we all do. On the reserves, and in the streets, and in the workplaces, in the schools, and in the homes, we're all here together. And if any one of us goes down, we all bleed. And we hold that person, as you saw a moment ago. Some of us in OCAP have learned some things from Ward Churchill. I certainly have. Not so long ago, a friend gave me a copy of a book that Ward had written, Pacifism as Pathology. Pacifism as Pathology. And there's a lot to be learned in that book, and I'll just say one thing. In there, Brother Churchill reminds us, as I recall, that we all live in a space that we surround ourselves with. And that space is the place and the way of being within which we feel comfortable. And we march, and we sign our petitions, and we talk to our friends and neighbors, and we get upset, and we do what we do, but most of us stay within that space, that comfort zone, because we don't like it when we get toward the margin of that. We don't like it because we don't know what's going to happen, and things start to be at risk. Our opponents have a comfort zone, too. OCAP moves out of the zone, because when OCAP moves out of the zone, OCAP's opponents don't feel very comfortable anymore. And that's how we try to move them. That's how we let them know that they're not separate from us. That's how we pay back the anxiety and the pain and the suffering and the humiliation that power delivers to all of us, and especially those of us who have little, and those of us that live on reserves, and those of us that may be brown and black and red, and those of us that this government and this economy has decided don't count. Well, we count, and we move against those who say we are nothing. I'll stop with that. Thank you again for coming. There's some calendars at a table out front, some OCAP calendars, some really spiffy photos in there. We'd like the support. Pick yourself up a calendar if you like. Thank you very much. Hope you enjoy the evening.
Thank you so much. That was James Porter, who's an OCAP member. And thank you, Rebecca, as well. Rodney was instrumental in bringing together tonight's events. And for all of us who have worked with him in the past, he's certainly in our hearts and in our minds tonight. And I think a lot of this event is sort of really in honor of his memory. With that in mind, I'd like to introduce Ward Churchill. Ward is an enrolled Kitiwa Cherokee and a professor of American Indian Studies at the University of Colorado at Boulder. He's a member of the Leadership Council of the Colorado American Indian Movement. He's a former national spokesperson for the Leonard Peltier Defense Committee. He's an author of many, many books, including A Little Matter of Genocide, Struggle for the Land, Pacifism's Pathology, and From a Native Son. All those qualifications notwithstanding, and I'm sure all the ones that I didn't mention, when I asked him how he wanted to be introduced, he said, "Say I'm an international troublemaker." So here he is.
CO. Osiju. Hello, my relatives. As was indicated in the introduction, my colonial name is Ward Churchill. I carry several others. I am by descent of Creek and Kitiwa Cherokee extraction, and by marriage in a traditional way, since we're both matrilineal peoples. Also as Lynx Clan, the Piju, Osabiskong Bay, by virtue of my marriage to Kiji Babanijik. And so I go by that name, as an indigenous name, the name that was given to me by the Piju, which is Kanis, or a little golden eagle. I carry a second, which will probably surprise some of you who know my work, this Kijinabe, which is a kind-hearted man. I bring you greetings from the elders of the Lynx Clan, from the elders of the Kitiwa Band of Cherokee, and from the Colorado chapter of the American Indian Movement, of which, as was mentioned, I'm a part, and also from Gwarthi Las, also known as Leonard Peltier, who, as I speak to you tonight, sits in a cage at the federal prison, Leavenworth, Kansas, not for any specific action that anyone, including even his prosecutor, has been prepared to say they actually believe he committed. They've not been prepared to say it at any point in the last 20 years in any event. But rather, he sits in that cage as a symbol of the arbitrary ability of the federal government of the United States to repress the legitimate aspirations to liberation of indigenous peoples within their claimed boundaries. emphasis there on claimed. And it's the nature of the resistance to that claim that was mounted by Gorthy Lass and by other people long before he was born and since he went to prison that will form the focus of what we speak to tonight. The framing of the topic is in terms of globalization, its relationship to genocide, its relationship to resistance, the relation there being how to resist. And overall, I'll say before I start that this subject is far too broad to be encompassed within a given lecture. A lecture, a series of lectures, a course, a study group. It's a vast subject matter. The purpose of a lecture, the purpose of interchange, and I do intend that there be interchange, is to plant seeds, see how those seeds grow, and what may be arising therefrom. So I propose to proceed in the following manner. I'm going to lay out several, I suppose you could call them vignettes, that are interconnected. And in the discourse of the academy, let's say there be some disjunctures between them. And let's also say that there's going to be holes because I'm going to be hitting highlights that serve to make my point and leaving deliberately and of necessity both more things unaddressed than I address. And that way maybe I can stop being a talking head early enough that we can actually get to some interchange and things that are of particular interest to you that I might not otherwise touch upon. And in that interchange, perhaps we can grow stronger together. But globalization, that's a current buzzword, globalization. I'm not sure who exactly invented it. It seems to have come into being as a term of the discourse along about the time that George Herbert Walker Bush, that is George the, what is he, 41st, as opposed to George the 43rd, who is currently enshrined in the highest office in the land south of the border here. By the time George Herbert Walker began talking about there being a new world order that he was ushering in, it was predicated on the notion that the world had to understand when the U.S. spoke, what we say goes. Maybe some of you recall that rhetoric and the context of that rhetoric, and it's very germane to events that made this a very long-standing process to get me here, and sometimes it's better to wait, as the turnout indicates. Maybe I should stop for a moment and express appreciation, say thank you, Osama bin Laden, but, well, I would probably be deported before I got to the next stop if I did that, so let's all pretend I didn't say it. Globalization, and opposition to globalization, because the framework of what we're going to be talking about really has to do as much with the anti-globalization initiatives and movement, whatever we're to call it, that's emerged in conjuncture with the rise of the rhetoric of globalization as it is about globalization itself. And the framing of my approach to it really comes from a very specific direction. Well, I guess you could probably say it comes from several different directions, but one has been paramount in my mind of late because I've been interacting pretty consistently over the last year or so with what is identified as the Black Bloc group of the Pacific Northwest, primarily in the U.S., but I understand they kind of go across the border too, and they're not necessarily exclusive to the Pacific Northwest, but there's this kind of enclave of them around the Portland, Eugene area that is testified to by the fact that they formed a joint terrorist task force in the United States specifically to deal with this group of people, most of whom are between 17 and 25 years of age. So they're attacking youth and a particular outlook of youth. And the Black Bloc individuals in that area who came to a certain kind of prominence in the anti-WTO protests in Seattle, Washington, are quite explicitly anti-globalist in their orientation. I don't know whether you can call anarchists an organization, but actually there is and there must be because anarchism is a self-fulfilling responsibility of interaction in organization. It's just another mode. In any event, in our conversations on globalization and what it was they were opposing, they had many things that I could agree with, but what struck me most forcefully in the entire exchange was the fact that they seemed to think that they were confronting something new, different, and unique. that in the conceptualization of it, it was almost as if they believed that they had invented the wheel, that they had recognized the face of the enemy, which had suddenly emerged, and that enemy was new, novel, and unique as well. And that brought me up short. But actually what it did was put me face to face with myself when I was about 25 years of age and on the Pine Ridge Reservation in the middle of the counterinsurgency war that was conducted by the United States against the American Indian movement and against the traditional Oglala Lakotas and their allies in and on that reservation for a 3-year period of time. A particularly brutal contest that left about 70 people out of a population base of 10,000 dead and another 350 seriously physically assaulted, facing about, in aggregate, something on the order of 17,500 years of penitentiary time, and put Leonard Peltier in the particular cage that he occupies tonight. And in that crucible, we had an advantage that's not shared too much by those black bloc kids up in the Pacific Northwest, and that is we had the active involvement of the Oglala elders, including the head man, Frank Foolscrow, and his assistant, Matthew King. Some of you may recognize that name. A few of the others among you may recognize him by another name. Matthew King was the name bestowed upon him in a boarding school down there. Up here, you'd call it a residential school. It didn't have anything to do with his name. And he knew it didn't have anything to do with his name, but he was bestowed with that name at such an early age that he didn't actually know what his name was, and so he simply signed formally when he had to sign a document, Noble Redman. So if you come across documents with the name written, in all seriousness, Noble Redman, that's Matthew that you've just encountered there. Well, about 2 years into that overall process, we were sitting around a security crew, and Matthew was sitting there with us, listening to us talk about what we were going to do next day, next week, what our plans were. And at a certain point, he kind of set down his cup of coffee, and he said, "You know, there's much about you young people that impresses me. I admire your energy. I admire your enthusiasm. I admire your commitment, your willingness to sacrifice for the people. These things are beyond question. But you're spinning your wheels." Well, that caught our attention, so everybody sort of sat around and looked at each other for a few minutes. And then finally, one of us screwed up the courage, because he's kind of an intimidating figure at the time. We're 25, he was 70. He'd forgotten more than most of us had learned yet. One of us really got bold and said, "Well, what do you mean, Uncle?" And he said, "Well, you got no sense of where you are. And so for all the energy that you exert trying to get there, you have no idea where you're trying to go." We looked at each other again, and he sort of saw the expectancy, so he explained. He said, "Well, compare it now to a journey, an actual trip. If you're walking or you're riding a horse across these plains out here, the way you know where you are at any given moment is you look over your shoulder at some landmark you passed along the way, and that'll orient you to your place in space. And once you have that understanding, you can plot your direction to get to whatever your destination might be. But if you don't have that orientation to where you've been, you can't understand where you are at the present. And if you don't understand that, you can't possibly figure out how to get to where you want to go." Literal journey is not the only way this works, he says. It's the same way with understanding yourself in time. If you don't know what has happened, if you don't know your history that took things from where things once were to where it is that things are now, you can't appreciate your present circumstance. And if you don't really see that clearly, you can't possibly figure out what it is you need to go to do to go where you want to go in terms of changing things. So whether it's space or whether it's time, it's going to work the same thing. You got to be looking over your shoulder and have a clear fix on where you've been in order to make any kind of constructive forward progression. Now, that's a traditional way of looking at it, and that's, of course, paraphrased. Matthew didn't put it exactly that way, but that's fairly close. And it's kind of germane, this idea, the globalization and its implications, somehow or another, are new, novel, and unique because the misunderstanding of that situation is so profound as to preclude any kind of positive address or redress of the circumstance in which we all intuitively, if nothing else, tend to find ourselves in opposition. And that in turn denies us of the possibility of achieving the kind of change that we all yearn for. Each in our different way, perhaps, but it's a yearning nonetheless, and it's a legitimate yearning, but a yearning is simply a yearning. It's an unfulfilled promise, unless it can be harnessed to a vision that allows for concretization of action. Now, one of the things that I've always been told I should try to do when I stand up here in front of a microphone and impersonate a talking head is to translate the things that come from the indigenous traditions into terminology drawn from another tradition that allows it to have what they call it in academia, maximum resonance. Okay, so we're going to try to maximize the resonance here a little bit. Now, what we're talking about, of course, is history. That's a fairly basic concept, not very well understood, but it's a fairly basic concept, and everybody pretends like they understand what it means. So we need to engage this in terms of, say, Western tradition, European tradition. Yeah, I'll mispronounce your names like you mispronounce ours, eh? Out of the European tradition, there's a number of theoretical paradigms by which history is approached. Several would present themselves, eh? We could take this up in terms of historical materialism, or we could take it up in terms of structuralism, or we could take it up in terms of, well, I could keep going through the isms and the ologies, but I think you get the drift. There's one that seems to me to be fairly useful and somewhat proximate in certain ways to the indigenous tradition, so let me lock in on that one. And it's also a matter of high theory, so it should be high-flown enough in order to satisfy the requirements of being allowed to speak in such an exalted forum as a university auditorium. The name Foucault resonate properly. Okay. Saying that name allows me to segue into another name, which is even more of a deity in the intellectual horizons of, well, I guess I'll just call Europe, Europe, which would be Freddie Nietzsche. Okay. Nietzsche. Foucault had a historical method that he lifted from Nietzsche. He called it historical genealogy. Now, coming from a tradition that uses genealogy, kinship, and the structures derived therefrom as a means of social organization and of understanding the polity and so forth, genealogy immediately appeals to me. But this is not the genealogy of people per se, it's a genealogy of circumstances. The idea that he posits, lifted from Nietzsche, as I say, is that you take that which you understand to be objectionable in the present circumstance. You have this intuitive, you have this visceral, you may have even an intellectual objection to some particular set of relations or arrangement. In this case, let's call it globalization. And if you can have at least a rudimentary definition of it, then you have an operating arsenal that allows you to trace its genealogy, that is, its preconditions, back to the point to which you find what he called a historical discontinuity or disjuncture. That is, when a point in time when things were different, when this that you find objectionable simply did not exist, and that will be your point of inception. So how do we go about defining that which we find to be objectionable in the present circumstance, this globalization thing? What is it? And I think probably a working definition that we could advance, perhaps oversimplified, but workable because there wouldn't be enough detail for half the room to object to it, would be that it is a structural interlock between state and corporation that allows for consolidation of a power block that is capable of projecting itself upon the world, exporting itself in terms of an order and a hierarchy that works to the detriment of all it encounters for the benefit of those who organized it in the first place. Is that complicated enough? Okay, and is this really new, novel, and unique? And the answer is, well, I think you can find historical preconditions that meet essentially that definition, but which are lacking some of its aspects. That said, you have to pose a question of, well, insofar as they lack all of its aspects, are they really preconditions? In other words, could the situation that we now encounter exist without those preconditions having existed? And the answer is going to be no. That's how you examine as you go back tracing the genealogy. Well, you got this precondition. Does it meet those requirements? Yes, it does. Okay, let's go to the next thing. What's the precondition of that? Yeah, okay, I see it now. Let's go to the precondition of, okay. We trace or peel the onion all the way back to where we find something that does not conform to the definition at all. Globalization. Where you end up if you trace the point of inception, the source, the origin of the process, if you will, is going to be a point in history about 1450 when the Portuguese set out to circumvent what they considered to be the Islamic barrier or wall, preventing them from direct interaction with what they at the time called the Orient, that is to the east, Asia in other words, from whence they expected through unfettered trade or ability to exploit and plunder to obtain considerable profit. And you have to understand that at that particular historical point, Europe is kind of a backwater. Islam is rich. They need to get around Islam, which is wealthier and militarily more potent than Europe, in order to be able to put themselves on a board to compete with it. And the only way they could figure out to do that, and it was a fairly logical thing, was to start sending ships down the west coast of Africa, trying to find where the bottom of Africa was so they could turn the corner and get to Asia. They never made it in that period, but what they figured out instead, having put into port places along the Ivory Coast and Nigeria in present day, is that they could turn a profit by impounding the people who they encountered on the shore, taking them back to Europe and selling them into chattel slavery. You have then the first, actually these were chartered corporate ventures, chartered by the state, first outward expansion from Europe of a power projection that allowed Europeans to act on the rest of the world in a way detrimental to their interests, but beneficial to those who had devised the scheme in the first place. This is the origin of the present process of globalization. Now, that's fairly embryonic. You got this other guy who ends up with African maps as a result, perhaps, of the first penetrations of west coast of Africa by the Portuguese, and who, in fact, sailed for the Portuguese as a slaver. His name was Cristobal Colon, Christopher Columbus, to those of you who are caught up in English, who tried to do it another way, sailing west to get east, figuring that this was a globe, which the Africans had already figured out and had probably already been here long before the Europeans stumbled upon it, which opens up the New World. Now you got genuine globalization on your hands. What you're going to find in this process is you got the initial forays, and the forays are followed by a relatively constrained ambition on the part of those who are setting forth into alien territory for purposes of profit and plunder, always under corporate charter sanctioned by the state. The corporations in those days, just as in these days, were the shock troops of empire. Columbus didn't go out in the name of science. Columbus also didn't go out, rhetoric to the contrary, notwithstanding, in the name of God. Columbus went out for gold and greed. And it says so right there in his documents. It says right there in his charter. It says right there in his journal. It says that consistently. On the initial encounter with this sort of constrained ambition, you have the exercise of sufficient military force to subordinate a population and gain a beachhead. And there's your original colonial toeholds. And on the basis of those and the profit that can be exported from those, you see the building or construction of the foundation for a next level of outward projection, consolidation of the colonial apparatus that's already been established, and the extension of the frontiers case by case by case around the world. It wasn't a uniform flow from one particular point on the globe to another. It's multipolar, just as it is now, if you think about it. There's not a single hub to the process of globalization at this point. There's going to be a linchpin, and I'll come to that, but there's a multipolar process that is occurring, and it was a multipolar process that was occurring at the time. But conquest and consolidation of a colonial structure with regard to the peoples encountered was a predicate at each step along the way for the next step that would be taken. Okay, I said we would come. I'll come in a hurry. To the fact that there is a linchpin in it. I can trace the evolution of this thing through 400, 500 years worth of history, but we really don't have time to do with that. If there's particular points in that progression that anybody's interested in and wants to raise once I'm done talking, then we can try to address them in some more specific detail. But let's say that the culmination of the process is that we have, at the present time, the linchpin or a hub that is predominating out of the matrix of hubs that have been created to make globalization an operant reality, and that would be the United States of America. North America, in other words. And when I say North America, actually, I really do mean North America, too, because the U.S., I grant you, only occupies, physically at least, a particular portion of the continent, but also face it, and I don't care if it irritates people up here, we're in the resource colonies that lie to the north. These are the northern provinces of the United States that we're resident to right here and now tonight. Okay? They figure into the geopolitical calculus of the United States as if it was an integral part of the United States, and they had the permission of the so-called leadership of Canada to do that. Canadian leadership sold itself to the United States for chump change 50 years ago, and the consequences and chickens and all the rest of it are coming home to roost right now. So if we're going to look at the relationality of things, and this is what we're supposed to be able to derive from Foucault's method, is that an understanding, if we can trace things back to understand the source or the origin of the particular thing we find objectionable, which we just did more or less rudimentary terms, we can then trace the evolution of the historical process forward, viewed through the lens of what it was we were objecting to in the first place, and understand what the component parts are in terms of historical evolution to make it possible for that objectionable circumstance to exist right now. We understand the ingredients. We understand what it is that must be done to change the situation that allows it to exist. And implicitly, at least, we begin to get signals or keys as to the nature of the process of opposition we need to engage in to affect that alteration or undoing of historical circumstance. Well, we understand that the hub of the globalization process now, unlike the past, is not in Western Europe, although Western Europe is a participant in the overall process. It's a partner with the United States in the process of globalization, but by no means a co-equal partner. Japan, the same thing could be said about, and there may be an emergent hub in South Asia, that remains to be seen. In any event, the linchpin is here. So what we really have to look at is a particular historical genealogy of the process as it occurred in North America, what the component parts that are emerged from that process, and in the process of that understanding of process, we come up with a sort of prescription of how to go about confronting it. Yeah. I'm a professorial type, and I feel like I should really stop and ask if there are questions. You all with me so far? Yeah, can't do that. This isn't that kind of talk. Afterwards, I'll ask you all to get out a rule sheet of paper and write a little essay review as to whether you absorbed all of this or not, but we won't do that just yet, okay? You don't go back to 1450 with North America. You can pick up several possible dates of inception, but the one that's actually operant would be 1607 when the English set up a permanent colony at what they call Jamestown. So you got the period from 1607 forward. And what's the key ingredient of what it is that happens? Well, you got a process by which indigenous peoples to the east side of the United States, and to a certain extent because concomitantly Spanish are coming up from the south, begin to subordinate, subjugate, colonize, actually integrate, in terms of their labor and resources, indigenous peoples into a paradigm of profit for themselves. If we were to look at South America, we could understand this more clearly, but ultimately, that's not the predominating history that we need to be involved with, because South America is not a hub either. It's simply not a resource park like Canada, only even more so. But using a South American example to illustrate, there's a single place in the Andean Highlands, which is Potosí, which was taken by the Spaniards. The indigenous population impressed essentially as slave labor for mining purposes exported enough silver from that one mine to form a bridge about 2 feet wide all the way across the Atlantic Ocean from the South American coastline to Spain. That's the immensity of the wealth that was being drawn into an impoverished Iberian peninsula at the time. Now, the Spaniards found themselves to be divinely ordained to do this, and insofar as they were the hand of God operating in the world, felt it beneath them to actually take this wealth and put it to use in industry themselves, and so they hired Northern Europeans to produce things like armament and cannons for expansion of their own conquistadorial ambitions, which actually becomes then the financial backbone of the Industrial Revolution, which allows for the real expansion to globalization. You cannot have that process occur in Europe without that process of conquest and colonization occurring here. But again, as I say, we're concerned with North America. In North America, its ability at this point to project power upon the planet in either corporate or economic terms is absolutely contingent upon conquest and consolidation of that conquest. That's the outright expropriation of the land of indigenous people, and in the residual corridors of that, the residue of population and the residue of land base being converted into perpetual energy colonies. You've got essentially this continental block formed on an internal colonial structure. Now, colony is something that kind of jangles with most North Americans when you talk about these megastate structures that have been established here, whether it's the United States or whether it's Canada, two of the largest countries in the world, overarching a multiplicity of nationalities in the name of nationalism. It's a real interesting paradigm, sort of intellectual sleight of hand that goes on. There seem to be controversy and contestation as to whether the descriptive terms that I'm using are actually even applicable here, because after all, we understand colonialism to function in a different way, and there's actually an entire discourse in academia now devoted to the description of the post-colonial environment. And if it's a post-colonial environment, it can hardly be talking about an internal or any other kind of colonial structure, because colony and colonialism are matters of the historical past. And that's another real slick and little sleight of hand that goes on. If you could declare something over, you don't have to combat it in the present. It's a matter of past. It's interesting, but we don't have to engage it now. Well, there is a particular mode of colonialism that arose in conjunction with that early phase of the process we're talking about that is, in fact, for the most part at least, over. And that would be the classic mode of external colonization that was engaged in by the classical European empires. English, French, Dutch, Portuguese, Spanish. Little countries, backwater countries when they start, who project themselves outward to the point where at a certain period in the early 20th century, 85% of the surface area of the planet's claimed by one or another of them. You get a globe that was manufactured in the 1950s, you're going to see it's all color-coded green and purple and pink and orange, okay? And you're going to see that the English homeland is pink, and all of the English colonies are pink, and they're everywhere. The sun never sets in the British Empire, okay? France is green. Netherlands is purple. Yeah, the entire world is color-coded as to which European power owns what, in their own mind at least. Well, that's over. Classic colonial period was over, okay? The 1960s were the great period of Third World Revolution, when there was a rollback of the classic colonial empires, which didn't necessarily mean that colonialism per se ended, because after all, undiscussed in that Three Worlds paradigm that we'll come back to in a moment, is the fact that there's two other varieties. There's internal colonialism and there's settler state colonialism. These are very much with us today. Let's go to the first one first. And we can do it in a vernacular that I think will probably, again, kind of resonate with you. You've all heard it. It's not much current anymore, although it's sort of rebounding a little bit. And it's a triadic arrangement that was devised by a French economic journalist sometime in the early 1950s and then popularized beyond belief by Mao Zedong at the Bandung Conference, and I think that was 1963, about 11 years later, a decolonization conference and a coordination of strategies among the colonized countries of the world. Countries as defined by the colonizers, by the way. And you all understand what where we're going here is to the three worlds paradigm. The way Mao laid it out was you got a first world. The first world is capitalist and industrialized. Second world is socialist and industrialized. And then you got the third world, and that's the term currency. Okay, third world is mostly to the south, predominantly colonized or recently decolonized, non-industrial, but underdeveloped is the term they use, but industrializing hinterland. There was some kind of left out there, worked at the time. But what it was that was left out was the fact that there is a fourth world upon which all of these other three worlds are constructed. That's the indigenous world, or as Winona LaDuke calls it, the host world. It's composed of peoples, nations, if you will, that are arbitrarily subordinated to the overarching superior vision of one of the other three. But that's not quite fair either, because that third world, the configuration of it, the national boundaries and so forth of it, was never created by the people who were resident to it in the first place, you see. What is India? What's the historical reality of India? What is Pakistan? When did Afghanistan come into being? And who begat it? Iraq, Kuwait. I can give you dates on each of these. Afghanistan came into being in, I believe it was 1884, as a result of a British administrator drawing a line on a map to establish an administrative compartment for the colonial project. India is 280 different nationalities that were lumped together and then subpartitioned into administrative units by British imperialists. The entire continent of Africa has an indigenous national configuration. There are boundaries to it. These are discernible, but in 1883, the European powers that had interests in Africa sat down in a conference room in Berlin, took a blank map of Africa, and drew out the boundaries that would suit their needs, having nothing at all to do with those of the African, having no consideration at all for the fact that they were partitioning peoples that had been in existence as nations since time immemorial. And you got, in the Maoist paradigm, a notion that there is some intrinsic legitimacy and integrity to those colonial compartments, and that each of them is deserving in its own right to be free to the shackles of external domination by colonial powers, and there's a legitimacy to that statement. The only thing is, as they decolonize, whether on a Gandhian nonviolent manner, or that was pursued by Nkrumah in Africa along the same axis, or whether by armed force, in the more classical forms of third world revolution, once the revolution has occurred and the colonizers had either agreed to be in another relationship with their former colonies or had been expelled by main force, the successful revolutionaries, by whatever definition you want to use to spell success here, treated those colonial arrangements, those boundaries that had been created by their opposition and their oppressors as if they were somehow or another sacrosanct writ by the hand of God and have been defending them ever since against the interests of the people who were forcibly amalgamated into these artificial state entities in the first place, and that is internal colonialism. Africa is just as colonized now as it was in 1945. It's just that there is a different arrangement to the colonial order, and it is maintained by Africans upon Africans. That is internal colonialism. India is as much a colonial state entity now as it was under British rule. Ask the Nagas, who have been fighting a 50-year protracted struggle to exercise self-determination in Nagaland, which pre-existed India by about, 3,400 years. And I can keep ticking them off around the world. That's internal colonialism. But we got this other variety, and this is the one that should really resonate here. Okay, it's where you got internal colonies, But you've got an imported population to administer them. You've got settlers who were brought in, not as a little administrative cadre, but as a population intended to supplant the indigenous population that was in the process of being colonized. This is settler state colonialism, where the predominant population becomes the settlers, and the indigenous population becomes a minority or less on its own land. Ultimately, out of sight, out of mind. Canada is a settler state colonial construction. The indigenous people are subordinated, subjugated, expropriated, and all the rest of those terms that come with colonialism by a population that considers itself to be in a post-colonial circumstance because it freed itself from the mother country. Oh yeah, there's no need in Canada to worry about colonialism after all, because Canada is no longer a British colony. We don't even bring indigenous people into consideration in the analysis here. And this city and its institutions predominate in what they call Commonwealth and post-colonial studies and discourse, particularly in the area of studying literature and text. We're going to read, 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 and we're going to write, write, write. And when we're done with that, we're going to have a liberated consciousness without ever even having addressed the issue. In fact, we foreclosed it. It's not worthy of discussion. Maybe I'll just sum up in post-colonialism right now. When my people are decolonized, we will talk about post-colonialism. But so long as I am in colonial bondage and my brothers and my sisters and my other relatives are, later for post-colonialism. We'll get to post-colonialism when it's post, you see. Not while it's an operant reality, denied to protect the privilege of those who benefit from our subordination. Thank you very much. I've never seen a single Native scholar make use of the term post-colonialism. And that's nowhere on the planet. That's not just here. I could refer you to a couple of pretty good indigenous texts objecting to the term for reasons that I just indicated if you'd like to pursue it in more depth, but later for that as well. So where have we just ended up? By listening to Elder Matthew, or I guess Nietzsche by way of Foucault. Well, we understand that the components, the bedrock components, if you will, that create the situation that enables the existence of the current phase of global power projection is inherent to the conquest and internal colonization, ongoing subordination, exploitation, expropriation, degradation. I can keep listing off the words, but I don't have to, of indigenous people. Let me give you just a little bit of a statistical array of what I'm on about here so you don't think I'm exaggerating or playing to effect. Now, I'm going to talk about south of the border primarily because that's where the locus of power rests, and that's also where I'm most familiar since that's where I'm from. But the same principle and probably the same proportionalities will pertain north of the border as well. The border, after all, was one of those colonial partitions. It has absolutely no meaning to me and mine other than it's something that gets in our way and is an ungodly hassle for no reason that we can discern most of the time. In the United States, two-thirds, it is estimated, of what the U.S. claims as its domestic uranium reserves are on reservation or within reservation boundaries. Down there, we call them reservations. Up here, the reserves. Same thing. Two-thirds of the uranium reserves. 25% of the readily accessible low-sulfur coal. 20% of the oil and natural gas, virtually all of the copper, such as they haven't mined out, such bauxite as U.S. can lay claim to, zeolites. Okay, quick test, university audience, what the hell is a zeolite? Yeah, well, we got them all. We got the richest deposit known on the planet on the Pine Ridge Reservation, which is the poorest location in North America, I think. If not, it's got to be heavily in contention. Zeolites, peculiar kind of ash, volcanic ash with a crystalline structure that allows it to be flattened out, compressed into sheets, and used as filters to decontaminate nuclear irradiated water. Oh, yeah, real important stuff. Can't find it anywhere else in nature, and they haven't figured out how to synthesize it. Nickel, industrial-grade diamonds. I can keep ticking off the resources, too. But basically, the bottom line is you remove these resources from the U.S. domestic economy, as they call it, and there is no U.S. domestic economy in the sense that the U.S. understands its entitlement to have an economy. Or you want to talk about it in a different way, the proportionality of land, we're constricted to 2.5% of our original holdings down there, okay, for nominal control, at least use and occupancy, okay? Although by treaty, we're entitled to be retaining about 35% of the whole, and that's according to the federal government's own claims commission. And by the way, you're getting a claims commission up here, get rid of it. Get rid of it. It's not a resolve the claims because we don't have any claims. Native people have no claims to land. We have rights to land. It's our land. Some of the rest of you may have claims, and you can press them with this, okay, but they take this vernacular and they turn reality squarely on its head, and they convince people this makes perfect sense. Then people keep talking about up as being down, black as being white, in being out, and all the rest of it. No wonder we're confused, but let's get over that one right now. Our land rights straight up are to 35% of the U.S. 48 contiguous states' territoriality, and we would need to expand the resource profile to accommodate that alteration in reality. But 98% of the territoriality is at issue overall. Of that 98%, about one-third is treaty land that belongs to us. Was never ceded. Another third is bound up in territory where you got fraudulent or coerced treaties. And I mean fraudulent by way of people signing other people's names to documents. I mean treaties that were sent in after having been negotiated and the Senate objected, so they rewrote the treaty after it was signed so that it said something completely different. The Native people were never asked whether they agreed. In some cases, never even informed of the alteration. It was considered to be binding law and a predication of title by the United States and so forth. You sift all that out in territorial terms, the United States no longer looks like the United States in the sense that it's come to understand itself. It doesn't have a continental reach and dimension. It's a fragmentary constellation of pockets of ceded land, which are unable to coalesce in the sense that would be necessary in order to mount the power projection in either economic terms or in military terms to do what's being done now. You're starting to get the drift on this? If you want to attack globalization as it's presently being formulated and projected on the planet, the point of departure, well, it's not to go out with a black bloc and break the windows at Starbucks, although that can be fun, and I'm not condemning it, you understand. All right. It is not to have a candlelit vigil and a march, even with the most elaborately embellished signs expressing your solidarity with the armed insurrection, as they call it in Mexico. It's occurring in Chiapas in Mexico. Although those people are perfectly willing to support, the fight is there for them. We have something here. And if we're going to be of service to them there, because they're burdened under something called NAFTA, which forms north of the Rio Grande, we need to be about making some changes in the locus of the projection of the power that's entailed in NAFTA. We need to be doing what they're doing down there, up here, in whatever terms make sense to us, can be applied here. You understand? What this is pointing to is if you're going to get at globalization, the number one priority is not external solidarity. It's not symbolic protest of corporations, which are symptomatic of the whole. It's not putting up posters or saying chants or writing better songs opposing all forms of killing and war as a platitudinal process. It's about undertaking the nuts and bolts, get down and dirty, gritty operation of decolonizing Native North America, restoring self-determining rights to Native people, restoring control over our entitled land base and the resources that attend it to the indigenous population whose property, whose destiny, whose legal, moral, and natural prerogatives to enjoyment thereof it is. There is no other agenda item that will address globalization in negative terms that has any particular meaning absent that. And I'm going to go further. But let me restate that one. If you want to effectively oppose globalization in the present form, in the form that is forthcoming in the immediate future, you have to undo the component parts that made it possible in the first place. And those component parts are the creation of the internal colonial structure of Native North America, overarched by these superstrates. You have to decolonize Native North America, priority number one. And that does not mean that you abandon all other priorities, both in the sense that one is seldom vested with a sole priority. There's usually a range of them. They form, oh, dastardly word, it's probably going to cause shockwaves of horror, hierarchy. The reason we don't have priorities, perhaps, is because intellectually we've gotten into opposing some abstraction called hierarchy. And in our opposition to it, we've come up with brilliant slogans like, there is no hierarchy to oppression. Excuse me. There is no hierarchy to oppression, say people who are opposed to the hierarchy, the, with a capital T and a capital H, the hierarchy. We're opposed to the hierarchy who oppresses us. It's a hierarchy, but of course it wouldn't oppress us in a hierarchical fashion, would it? The hierarchy will work in an anti-hierarchical manner, will unto me, in contradiction, giveth a break. If it's a hierarchy that's doing the oppression, then of course the oppression is going to be hierarchical. It's going to have preferred targets. It's going to have lesser targets, okay? And we need to understand those. We need to understand the hierarchy, and on that basis form some priorities of what our limited resources are going to be devoted to engaging. And priorities in themselves are a hierarchy. If you're going to have priorities, you're going to have to embrace rather than reject hierarchy in principle. There's particular forms of hierarchy you may be able to oppose properly, but not hierarchy in principle. So, now I've addressed postmodernism as well as postcolonialism. Thank you. But guess what? In the tracing of the historical genealogy, you find that the forms of oppression that are visited by other people in North America, whether it's in Canada or whether it's in the United States, whether we're talking about racism or classism or sexism or ageism or environmental devastation or any of the rest of these objectionable things, are all predicated on the conquest and colonization of Native North America. They couldn't have done any of that that came after without doing that which came before. If you decolonize Native North America, you eliminate the basis for these other kinds of oppression, okay? And so you're solving your own immediate agenda in the process of accomplishing something broader, and what on earth could be wrong with that? See, we're a little hierarchy, self-interest, in confluence with compassion for others and a recognition of the problem can get you. Probably not published, but... yeah. So, okay, that's sort of the summative thing on globalization. And I'm not going to take it much further on that front right now. I'm going to leave that for Q&A. I think I've laid out enough to either excite or irritate enough people that we can probably have interchange on it. And again, I've intentionally left a whole lot that probably needed to be said out, partly in order to shape it in interaction with you, but I think you got the drift of what I'm talking about there. So let me go on to the other part of what is supposed to be involved in what I was going to say tonight, and then I'll shut down and we'll get into the rough and tumble into things. And that goes to the relationship between globalization on the one hand and genocide on the other. And I'm approaching this from the premise that people understand that genocide in and of itself is something to be opposed, but there's whole molecular strings of implication in terms of mentality and practices string out of the phenomena of genocide that have negative implications for everyone involved or around the process, including even the perpetrators, and on that score, ask the Germans. They know real well. Well, what I've done is make an argument in the globalization end of things that globalization itself is simply an ever more evolutionary form of colonial consolidation. And that takes me to another mighty French intellectual, this one by the name of Jean-Paul Sartre, who in 1968, as a corollary endeavor to the Russell Tribunal, Lord Russell's Tribunal, which was dedicated to examining charges of U.S. war crimes in Southeast Asia, a neocolonial endeavor, took on a study as to whether the allegations that what the U.S. was engaged in was actually, in a legally definable sense, genocidal. The result of this was an essay, actually. It's not a particularly long thing, but it's a very important thing. It's called On Genocide. It was published in Ramparts magazine in early 1968 and subsequently published in conjunction with an array of the data that had been amassed by the tribunal to illustrate the point as a small book. You can probably find it in used bookstores around in Montreal or Toronto or Amazon.com, for that matter. We are in this cyber age, and you can find all kinds of wonderful things out there. Yeah, you just need to pay for it. Okay. Sartre started by examining the nature of the U.S. strategy, which was rather blunt, wasn't particularly elegant. It was a strategy of attrition. An attritional strategy, as was employed by Westmoreland in Southeast Asia, means simply you kill them and you kill them and you kill them and you kill them, and finally you will have killed enough that they can no longer sustain the fight. No finesse involved at all. Superior firepower, that's it. And on the face, not surprisingly, he determined that it was intrinsically genocidal to approach warfare in this fashion because the entire population was targeted. But he said, you know, this was a neocolonial endeavor. And this raises more questions for me. And so having, in about 5 pages, adduced that there was substance to the charges against the United States on the basis of genocide, legally defined, he went on to examine whether there wasn't a relationship inherent to colonialism, neocolonialism, these forms of domination on the one hand and genocide on the other. And he examined the French performance in Algeria primarily and a couple of other examples in a secondary sense, and he adduced the following equation, which was very, very controversial, as you can imagine, in the hallowed corridors of academia, particularly in the States, but to a certain extent up here as well, and that was that colonialism equals genocide. That if you impose and maintain a colonial order, you will inherently have to engage in lines of policy and action that will have a genocidal effect upon the subordinated population. Now, you got some cynical objections that were raised by people who knew better, and then you got another, and this is the majority of the objections that were raised to Sartre that made him so almighty controversial, because of a profound misunderstanding of the meaning of the term genocide. Most of the responses seem to be keyed to the notion that genocide is a synonym for Auschwitz, and that insofar as you could not discern Auschwitz per se in the course of most colonial endeavors, that genocide was an exaggeration or a misnomer in its application. I say that's a profound misunderstanding of the term because, well, let me put it to you this way. Auschwitz occurred in a particular context with regard to the Nazi Judeocide. And even in the context of that particular process, it was not paramount. About one-third of the people who died as a result of that Nazi policy died in Auschwitz or comparable camps of Operation Reinhardt, the extermination centers. About half of all the people who died as a part of that process died by way of malnutrition, lowered resistance to disease, and epidemic diseases that spread after being walled into ghettos, mostly in Poland, to a certain extent in the Baltic states. And the balance were shot and dumped into anti-tank ditches by the Einsatz group in Eastern Europe. So even in the sense of, quote, the Holocaust, end quote, Auschwitz was not definitive. And Auschwitz, even in this distorted sense that it is used, is signifying of outright killing. And in the conceptualization of the term genocide by Raphael Lemkin in 1944, it is acknowledged that killing is a means to accomplish a genocide, of which there have been many historically, he said. It's not a unique process, but that's historically exceptional. Usually, it is undertaken by non-lethal means. Take a deep breath, and I'll repeat it. Genocide is usually undertaken by non-lethal means. In the legal codification in the 1948 Convention on Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide, there are four different categories of state action elucidated as being genocidal. One and one only involves killing members of the target group. That's 20% of the definition. The other 80% involves non-lethal means. Genocide, as defined by Lemkin, and he coined the term, is any policy undertaken with the intent to bring about the dissolution and disappearance of a targeted population group. Now, that's refined to read racial, ethnical, national, or religious population groups. There's others conceivable, but they're not listed in the law. So it's probably worthwhile to run down what the other four criteria are so you understand the relationality that Sartre, having actually looked at the thing, was responding to when he equated colonialism and genocide. Now, these are aspects of the colonial order. I'll bounce back and forth between the United States and Canada, but since we're in Canada, I'll try to use Canada as point of reference where possible. The first of the five has to do with killing. Now, for those of you who'd say Canada didn't do much killing, that's okay. You can say it because it says killing members of the group simply on the basis of their membership in the group. Doesn't say how many you got to kill. Doesn't say what proportion you got to kill. Simply says you're targeting and killing people on the basis of their group membership. You're killing an Indian, or you're killing a black, or you're killing whoever you're killing simply because they're a black or they're an Indian. If you're doing that, it's not just murder, it's genocidal mode of murder. Meets the criteria, legally speaking. And that certainly has happened in Canada, hasn't it? Oh, yeah. And not just in the 19th century. Happened more in the United States. We can take that one right up. But it's a schoolyard polemic to say, well, they do it too, and they even did it worse than me. Okay, granted. Now you're still guilty. That's how that one works, boys and girls. Okay, now that we've gotten past third grade in terms of national polemic of defense, let's get to the ones that actually count, and let's talk a little bit about Canada's response to them. Second one is to implement a policy designed to impose severe physical or psychological harm upon the members of the target group. The idea being, if you can make it in a manner short of lethality, so uncomfortable for them to remain identifying members of the group that's been targeted that they will voluntarily, and put quotes around that, disassociate themselves from the group is ultimately going to go into a process of dissolution, and if that's carried far enough, disappear. Well, look at the economic statistics and so forth with regard to Aboriginal people in Canada over, say, I don't know, the last 100 years, and you start to get a little flickering there, a little glimmer maybe, that there's been some policy-driven mechanism that makes them rather physically uncomfortable. You could call it even severe physical harm, since people are dying of malnutrition and easily curable diseases and such at astronomical rates in the context of an advanced industrial society. Okay, you want to talk about psychological harm? Well, turn on a TV. Now, Canada doesn't do all this. It just imports it and decides that it's okay. to watch NFL football and the Washington Redskins, for example, and publish tumbleweed cartoons and run John Ford movies and buy Jeep Cherokees and Winnebago campers. And shall I continue? How many place names in Canada do you have that include the word squaw, and what does it mean? Come on, brave soul out there. I actually am asking a question, and it's not just professoral. This is actually part of the deal. Thank you. Yeah. You didn't have to go to anthropology class for that. You just needed to go down to Six Nations and ask them, because it's a word from there. Okay, and it means female genitalia. And it's used as hip slang by the settler population to address any indigenous female. Doesn't matter whether it's an elder woman, mother expectant, or a six-year-old little girl. And although most of the people using it at this point don't really understand what it means, a lot of us do, and you can imagine the degradation and so forth that goes with that. And when we object, we're told it's okay, like they said about the Redskins just yesterday, we intend to honor you with it. Yeah, well, try playing that little record in English translation in women's studies. Walk in and call a receptionist the translation of squaw in English and see where that gets you. And when the objection comes, tell her, what's your problem? I was just trying to honor you. Yeah. Psychological harm. And that's ubiquitous. It's endemic. It's defended. So there's those two. Third one doesn't target the people per se at all. It's to create conditions leading to the physical destruction of the group. So you're targeting that upon which the group depends for its survival as a group in being. Well, here's one condition you could do. How about a relocation program that is an incentive to take people off their land and disperse them in cities? I don't know what your data is up here, but it's probably pretty close to the United States. And in the United States, 55% of the entire population of recognized indigenous people is dispersed from the reservations into urban enclaves where they disappear. And that happens in every city in Canada as well, with the possible exception of Winnipeg, where there's damn near more Indians dispersed into the city than there are non-Indians administering to their affairs. You call Winnipeg the largest urban reservation in Canada if you want, but the point still stands. It's a dispersal, and a group cannot retain its integrity, its existence in being, if it's dispersed across a continent. You have a diaspora of Native people in North America that's been policy-driven and created for the purpose of dividing and weakening us, of undermining our culture and so forth. If that process in and of itself were simply carried to its conclusion, there would be no culturally identifiable indigenous people remaining in Canadian borders, a principle the United States figured out a long time ago. And I don't know how many of you actually have done much intensive legal study or study on Aboriginal policy in Canada, but what you'd find in comparison to the United States is everything the United States does, Canada does within the next 10 years. You read judicial opinion in Canada, you find them on Aboriginal affairs citing the Marshall decisions of the 1830s, which are definitive in the formation of federal Indian law in the United States. They're also formative in terms of Canadian Indian law. And let me tell you, that record doesn't play in reverse. You'll never find a Canadian precedent cited in a U.S. court. But Canadian precedent is riddled with reference to the U.S. So what I talk about when I talk about in the U.S. applies to Canada in a more or less direct fashion. So dispersal is one. How about you attack the environment? How about, as with the Great Whale Project, when they planned that, you simply submerged the entire homeland of the people under about 150 feet of water for a hydro project? What happens to the people then? Well, I guess they get dispersed, but whatever else can be said, they cannot maintain their way of life and constitute themselves as a group and being projected into the future. That process of dissolution and ultimate disappearance as a recognizable human group is ushered in through that means. Fourth one has to do with preventing births among the target group. And as Lemkin pointed out, the reason we don't talk about genocide as a synonym for mass murder is, and the reason you don't have to kill anybody in order to perform genocide is because, for example, you could simply biologically eradicate their capacity to reproduce, sterilize them, in other words. It's conceivable with a small target group. You simply sterilize everyone of childbearing age or younger. and you've killed no one, but at the end of a single generation, they go out of existence in biological terms as surely as if you'd stood them up against a wall and blown their brains out. Mark that one, because I'm coming back to it in terms of Canadian practice in a minute. And the fifth and final one has to do with the forced transfer of children from the targeted group to the targeting group, so they will be raised to understand themselves as someone other than who they were born to be. And I've got two words to say to everybody in Canada: residential schools. Exactly the purpose stated in black and white repeatedly by officials in Canada was the residential schools were created, administered, and sustained for the specific purpose of destroying the cultural identity of every student who went through them. They were not entirely successful, although they caused incredible carnage, psychologically, intellectually, and otherwise. And they didn't get every student, but it was not for lack of trying. Yeah. So, 5 for 5, you got genocidal ingredients bound up in the Indian policy of the mega state of Canada, the settler state of Canada, the internal colonial state of Canada. And all of these 5 emerge as part and parcel of the colonial process, serving as a perfect validation for the Sartrean equation of colonialism to genocide. You need look no further than Canada to see the truth of the correlation he made. Canada has signed on to the Genocide Convention, unlike the United States. I come from the U.S. See, what I just ran down was a diluted version of what Lemkin had in mind as being a genocide convention. The United States and Canada primarily gutted the thing, and then the United States refused to sign it at all for 40 years, specifically because it knew it would be self-indicting, both on its Indian policy and with regard to its refusal to terminate the operations of the Ku Klux Klan and so forth, all of which could be construed as genocidal activity, either condoned and sanctioned or actually perpetrated by the U.S., and their response was, well, we'll just refuse to sign the law. Doesn't mean the law is not the law. How many of you signed a murder statute? Okay, I guess you can all run out and create mayhem. You haven't signed on, so you're exempted from compliance with the law. Well, that doesn't work that way. It doesn't work that way for nation states either. But there's this little power equation. Okay? Canada, on the other hand, at least cosmetically endorsed the Genocide Convention, ratified it, and effected an implementing statute in 1952. Funny thing, though, I just ran down 5 criteria that are in the 48 Convention that was supposedly ratified and effected by domestic statute in Canada. The Canadian statute shows 3. And there's a real interesting little explanation of this in the parliamentary minutes. It's explained actually by representatives of the Canada Bar Association, ratified by the Parliament, that several of the criteria in the Exton Convention pertain to recent events in Europe. They're talking about what the Nazis did during the Second World War and have no particular relevance to Canada. Okay? So we don't need them in our law. So what did they delete? Killing, for example. No, they kept killing. They weren't doing any killing, so it was okay to keep that one. It can be illegal since we're not doing it. What they deleted was the forced transfer of children and infliction of significant physical and psychological harm. They kept the ones they weren't doing. They deleted the ones they were guilty of. Interesting mode of legal compliance here. You just get to tailor the law to what it is you're not doing. 1986, the Canadian Genocide Statute was revised. They deleted sterilization. That ought to be setting off flares for somebody in the room. Anybody that would be opposed to involuntary sterilization targeted on people of economic and racial groups because they're considered to be objectionable, surplus population, extraneous, or whatever, you find that that is a violation of women's rights, of human rights, of other kinds of rights, as much as sent you a signal. We've implemented these things on the sly. That's why we removed the criteria of illegality from our enforcement statute. Do I have the specifics on that? No, I don't. I'm simply telling you, go look. They sent you a loud and clear message. I would suppose very few people in this room knew that. Well, now you do. Now you do. In opposition to genocide, one is compelled again to make priority number one the decolonization of indigenous people, because we are directly, internally colonized by the state. Insofar as we are maintained in a situation of colonial domination, we are being subjected to genocide. In the terms, in the forms just covered. But let me give you one, and then I'll close, example of the urgency of the situation. The conditions on the reserves are probably emblematized by this particular fact better than anything else I could imagine to say. 5 years ago in northern Manitoba, 7 in every 10 Aboriginal children on a reserve between the ages of 9 and 12 years old were actively engaged in inhaling gasoline, not only to obliviate their consciousness of the reality they were inhabiting in the moment, but in full knowledge that the effects were apt to be permanent. This is a figurative suicide that is affecting 70% of all reserve-based children in a Canadian province. In the data on other provinces like Labrador are not appreciably better. And you couple that to the literal suicide rate, which runs about 1,400% the national average in age group. And stop and ask yourself a real simple question. What is it that could be so horrible in the life of a 10-year-old child that they would intentionally, if not literally, take their life, attempt to blot out their consciousness because so that they would not have to deal with that reality ever, ever again? And if you answer that for one child, then try extrapolating it to 7 in every 10. That's the circumstance that we live with. That is a circumstance which, by any reasonable definition, is genocidal, and anyone of consciousness who would attempt, by whatever means are appropriate, to end the genocide has to make that decolonization process their top priority. So whether you look at it in terms of opposition to globalization, or you look at it in terms of the simple humanity of opposing genocide, or whether you look at it in terms of a progressive agenda item that you'd like to see fulfilled, no matter how you come at it from that triangulation, we have this particular priority, the irrevocable alteration of the structure of the megastate of Canada that is entailed in the decolonization of Aboriginal Canada, the fulfillment of self-determining rights of Aboriginals in Canada. There's no equivocation. There's no debate. There is a common interest in humanity, materially speaking, and in every other fashion to that. And if we can agree on that, we have a common ground from which we can go forward together to define what it is that is appropriate, what it is that's necessary, what it is that must be done to alter the situation in the manner that I just described and forge together a future that is vastly more inhabitable and inviting for our children, a generation and 2 generations and 7 generations into the future than the ones we have inherited. That is a noble aspiration, and it is a fundamental human obligation, not just for Native people, but for all of us. Thank you.
Ooh.